That was a pretty good talk. I scheduled myself in the wrong slot, I guess, because I had to follow that. Both of those talks are actually really excellent. Kind of a common theme for both of the talks this afternoon have been targeting the tumor, because obviously, you know, for 30 years now, people have tried to do immunotherapy for cancers, and you can upregulate T cell activity, and you can block downregulation of T cell activity, but often those approaches don't yield really good results because inside the tumor there are problems with the T cells when they get there, and they just don't function, whether they're highly activated tumor infiltrating lymphocytes or you're blocking checkpoint inhibitors. You still have to get activity within the tumor in order to get results. So we've been interested in looking at that problem, and so my talk is going to be looking at mesenchymal stem cells that are engineered for carrying out immunotherapy within tumors themselves. The same disclosures as earlier, so I'm going to talk some about the perioperative immunologic microenvironment. Some data is about what the changes are just from having surgery itself. Then we'll talk about mesenchymal stem cells, some of the basic biology, and some stem cell engineering opportunities in mesothelioma and surgery. So the perioperative immune environment, you think it wouldn't be that big of a deal, but there are some data that suggests that surgery may not be the best thing if you're trying immunotherapy. So I'm going to look at some studies that suggest that actually surgery itself may be immunosuppressive, or at least affect the microenvironment to prevent the immune system from functioning. And then we're also going to look at some measurements at UCLA in PD patients who we've been trying to figure out that exact strategy. So there's some general knowledge in mesothelioma patients that patients who have poor survival often will have increased M2 macrophages and monocytes in their tumors. And this is just a gross observation that those patients tend to have poor prognosis. There's no assumption of any kind of mechanism, but that's just been an observation. And also there have been a group of patients with improved survival with increased CD8 positive T lymphocytes just found in tumors, so there's an increased infiltrate. So these are some hints that the tumor microenvironment may differ between different tumors, and it may have something to do with the prognosis. And this is the thing I showed earlier this morning about all the anti-mesothelin strategies for treating patients, but I want to again talk about the CRS-207 vaccine, the W-deleted Listeria monocytogenes vaccine. And this is some data that actually Dr. Singhal, who was here a number of years ago, produced looking at mouse flank tumor models. Let me just get this here. Where a tumor is injected on the flank of an animal, and then it's allowed to grow, and this is the growth curve here, and then at the point when it gets to be a certain size of over 200 cubic millimeters, they actually resect it, but leave enough for it to grow again. So it's a subtotal resection, kind of like we do in humans. So then it grows again, and you have a recurrent tumor. So they looked at these tumors independently as two different tumors, and they treated the animals with CRS-207 vaccine on a weekly basis, both in a primary tumor and in the regrowth tumor. And they got some interesting results which showed that in the primary tumor with the vaccine, you can actually vaccinate the animals and the growth of the tumor is dramatically decreased. However, you do the same thing in animals who had undergone surgery, you find that there is no growth retardation and the tumor grows naturally and the vaccine is not effective. So this would suggest that recurrent LLC tumors are different, and they looked at those and they found that the population of M2 macrophages was increased dramatically in the recurrent tumors, and maybe that had something to do with it, and they also, with the loss of efficacy of CRS-207. So they did some depletion studies looking at depleting CD4 cells and macrophages, and they found that if they did that, they restored the ability of the tumor to respond to the vaccine. So if you're looking at the model of a tumor where there's tumor cells in the red here and yellows are mesenchymal cells, the stromal cells that are supporting that tumor, there's an interaction with these cells with each other and with the outside environment. And there are T cells that theoretically should be coming in and invading the tumor and destroying it. However, there's a lot of influences on the T cells to prevent them from doing that, including suppressive cytokines and chemokines, as well as myeloid suppressor cells, T regulatory cells, that all serve to stop the T cells from functioning, particularly within the microenvironment of the tumor. So there are some immunosuppressive mediated mechanisms, including the PD-1 axis, which we've heard about a lot about, cytokines, including TGF-beta, IL-10, IDO, and arginase. Those are all immunosuppressive, and also the cellular infiltrates, including the M2 macrophages and T regulatory cells. So this all serves to block the T cells from functioning, and so one of the jobs that we need to do, since there are reactive T cells, and you can find them in most tumors, is they don't function very well. So the idea is we need to find some way to change the tumor microenvironment so that they will function. So we want to tip the scale, so to speak, from tumor growth to T cell growth and tumor lysis. So ways you can do that theoretically would be to do immunostimulatory cytokines, which include IL-2, which has been looked at years and years ago, as well as in other studies and other tumors, but also IL-12, also interferons, alpha and beta. There's a number of studies looking at that with gene therapy from Pennsylvania, and also the data I presented earlier with interferon alpha and clinically. And there's also kind of a question of how do you get it there? So do you just give it intravascularly, systemically, and hope that it gets there, or do you actually give it to the intratumoral injections or intraoperatively? So those are some of the questions that we're looking at. So one of the things about IL-12, which we became more interested in, is that it's involved with the whole process of antigen presentation in dendritic cells and monocytes, macrophages. It serves to stimulate T cells, so gamma interferon production, cytolysis, as well as proliferation. It also works on the NK axis as well to stimulate NK cells, but also it pushes T cells to a Th1 phenotype as well. So it's got a lot of positive effects. If you go back and look at some of the basic data when IL-12 was first looked at, this is some experiments from Michael Brunda, who looked at IL-12 in the treatment of Ranke tumors in mice, and these Ranke tumors are renal tumors. This was just looking at treating them with IL-12, which the high curve is the control curve, and then if you treat with high and low dose IL-12, you get these two curves way down here at the bottom of the thing with really good tumor suppression. And in order to kind of figure out what the mechanism was, the animals were given anti-CD4 antibody as well as anti-CD8 antibody, and only the anti-CD8 antibody partially reversed the success of IL-12. But the anti-CD4 did not, so it was a CD8 dependent mechanism. Then, kind of an interesting study that was done again in animals. These were Ranke tumors that were given under the capsule of a kidney, and then they were subsequently, about 12 days later, resected. So it's kind of like the kind of thing when you do with mesothelioma, but because they're already metastatic at that point, the mice still die despite the resection. And they were looking at combining IL-12 and IL-2 in this study. And the control group of the survival animals is here. And then the IL-12 and various IL-2 is here, right next to it. So it didn't really do anything. IL-12 in low and high doses here. So there was a little effect of that alone. But if you combined IL-2 and IL-12 together, you got these high curves with actually a lot of cured animals. So it's curious that IL-2 and IL-12 may work together, particularly in this situation where you have a resected tumor with micrometastatic disease present. So this kind of led to a clinical trial, and it's kind of an interesting clinical trial. They did an IL-12 versus interferon alpha in renal cell carcinoma. It was planned to be a targeted 80-patient trial with hopefully a presumed 25% response rate, which is a little bit aggressive, I think, but 50% percent of the patients actually had already had a nephrectomy. So it was similar to the mouse model where the tumors have been taken out, but they have metastatic disease, and they see whether it works, and they are given IL-12, but not IL-2. They're given IL-12, and they're also randomized to either that or interferon alpha with a 2-to-1 randomization. So a total of 30 patients, and 16 patients were treated, and it was actually stopped early, so it didn't reach the 80-patient point. But one of the things they found out with giving IL-12 is that it's somewhat similar to interferon, in that you have a lot of flu-like symptoms early on, so you have to give a lower dose, and you get a gradual dose escalation. So you went from 0.1 micrograms per kilo to 0.5 to 1.25 over a period of 3 weeks in order to handle those symptoms. And then they chose to give the IL-12 on days 1, 8, and 15 of a 28-day cycle. So, you know, kind of there's lots of different choices you could have made to administer the IL-12, but this is what they chose. And interferon was given kind of in the standard way of 3 times a week. So they had grade 3 and 4 toxicity in only 2 patients, but the trial was stopped early because they only had 2 responses out of the first 30 patients with IL-12, so they decided that wasn't enough, so 7%. So you don't know. If they would add IL-2, they might have found something different. So it's still kind of intriguing. So I'm going to talk about now kind of some of the stuff that we found in our patients at UCLA in terms of the tumor microenvironment. So you kind of figure out how does a proactive decortication procedure itself affect the immunologic microenvironment inside the chest postoperatively or perioperatively. And so one of the things that we decided, that since we put 4 chest tubes in these patients, is that we have pretty good access to their chest, at least in terms of drainage from fluid, and that can reflect what's going on the inside. So we collected the drainage from the chest tubes over the postoperative period and banked it and then started looking at it. And so the chest tube drainage was collected for each 24-hour period from approximately 24 patients. Then we also collected chest tube drainage from 20 cardiac patients who had undergone heart surgery but only had the chest entered incidentally, and they had a chest tube placed, so there really wasn't any pleural procedure done. It's kind of a mock procedure. So this showed the secretome, more or less, of the results of what we found. And you might expect there's a lot of neutrophil-stimulating cytokines, IL-8, G-CSF, and GRO here. They're all involved with kind of acute reaction. There was some MCP3 and IL-6 and other things that weren't that elevated, but one of the things was there was no detectable IL-12 at all. So we found that kind of interesting. And the cardiac patients, there was really very little. There's a little bit of some of the inflammatory cytokines, but everything was down at the baseline. So all these other ones are specific, at least to do the operation that we do with mesothelioma. So one of the questions is, how do we modify this microenvironment? Because if it's really immunosuppressive, then we want to kind of change that either during the surgery or afterwards. I mean, there's different ways we can do that. So one of the things that we were thinking about is mesenchymal stromal cells, which exist within healing surgical sites, obviously, in order to heal, as well as within tumors, when they also can support tumor growth. And so there's a whole duplicity of these cells and what they may do in each of these different environments. So we also were learning a lot about mesenchymal stem cells, their biology, and some of the uses that they've already been used for in clinical trials. Most of the mesenchymal stem cells that have been used are for immunosuppressive purposes in things like graft versus host disease. They've been used in clinical trials for diabetes, for pulmonary fibrosis, for MS, but none of them have really shown any real differences except for maybe some immunosuppression in graft versus host disease. So I'm going to look more at mesenchymal stem cells and the biology. So some of their properties are is that they can be harvested from a number of different places. They can be harvested from bone marrow very commonly. They can also get adipose tissue. That was one of the things that my UCLA plastic surgeon developed many years ago, is how to do that in a single application from liposuction, and also umbilical cord blood and full-term placentae. And the thing about this is that they have to be obviously multipotent. They have to be able to differentiate into bone, cartilage, muscle, including fat cells, as well as potentially neurons and other things. So that's an important part of it. It's again mentioned that these uses of this so far have suggested that they may be immunosuppressed or at least immunoprivileged. Obviously, a stem cell from something like a placenta is interfaces between the mother and the fetus, and so it has to somehow be tolerant of two different MHC cells, so that it, that may be the whole mechanism of why it's immunosuppressive, more or less. It does allow these tissues to potentially be given to allogeneic individuals, so it may not be rejected as rapidly as just regular allogeneic cells. And also, there's some question and some data that suggests that these cells actually traffic to injured tissues and tumors specifically. So we're going to look at that. Transferred MSCs, if they do traffic in particular to tumors, then could possibly be used to provide genes for immunotherapy versus for cytokine delivery and that kind of thing specifically. So one of the things we developed is just the ability to harvest stem cells. We actually got a number of placentas from our fertile group and harvested them. They're pretty easy to digest and collect, and you adhere them and then collect them over a period of about 4 weeks. They purify with the usual media, and then you can cryopreserve them and look at them. And so there's criteria that people use for mesenchymal stem cells that you need, and one of them is they are plastic adherent, they look like fibroblasts, they're self-renewing, obviously, and they multiply at about every 24 hours. There are CD44, 73, 90, 105, and 106 positive, and CD45, 34 in particular, 19, and HLDR negative. HLA class 1 is usually positive, although some people have said otherwise, and they're pluripotent, so you have to show that. So in our cells that we started harvesting and developing, this is looking at CD73 versus 105, and you can see that all the groups are in the positive range, and these are a bunch of different passages and been either frozen and thawed and then repassaged, and no matter what we do to them, they seem to maintain the CD73 and CD105 phenotypes. This is looking at HLA class 1, and they're all positive again, no matter what the passage, and whether they've been frozen or thawed or whatnot. So that's fairly stable. This is looking at a whole bunch of negative phenotypes as a cocktail that's added in, and they're always negative also. However, CD90 has been a variable marker. It's been good initially in low passage cells, but once you passage to the 12th to the 15th passage, they tend to become more negative again. However, if you freeze and thaw early passage cells, they tend to maintain the CD90 phenotype. We were able to get these cells to differentiate. This is in the chondrocyte, so this is a piece of cartilage here in the middle. This is osteocytes that you see, the orange or red osteocytic material. And this is lipoid differentiation. This is fat cells in there. So they do what they're supposed to do pretty much, except for the CD90 is variable, but we don't really know what that means. Nobody's really been able to describe what just an isolated CD90 change, what that means to stem cells. So what I want to talk about now is just some potential opportunities to use stem cells for in terms of cancer immunotherapy. So there's different things that we can use to treat, like I mentioned before, IL-12, IL-2, IL-15, OX40, and interferons. And so what we wanted to do is actually do gene transfection of our stem cells and see if we can use them to traffic these cytokines to the tumor and microenvironment. So we decided, since we have an interest in interferon alpha, to do that, and then ultimately we tried IL-12. There's obviously limitations of cytokine therapy, which I'm not going to really go into because we're not going to get that point. But so what we did is we took an adeno-5 virus and got an interferon alpha construct as well as IL-12. And then we transferred them into mesenchymal stem cells, and we looked at what their phenotype changes were, and then tried to look at the secretion and the effects on the cells themselves. This is our gene insert that we got, and it's got, the IL-12 has got two subunits that are linked together, and we also did the same thing for interferon alpha. And then these are some of the phenotypes we looked at afterwards to make sure that we didn't change anything by doing this. And in fact, the cells were CD73 and CD105 positive. These are the interferon transfected one. These are mock, and these are the baseline cells. So they didn't change. CD90 didn't change, and HLA-DR was negative on all of them, as well as the cocktail, and class one was always there. So it didn't seem to change anything. We looked at the secretion of interferon in the culture media. After 24 hours, every 24 hours, we would change the media and see how much was produced. And we got a reasonable amount of interferon alpha every 24 hours, and so it seemed to be producing what it's supposed to produce. We did this with both IL-12 and interferon, and then we looked at the kind of secretome again of the cells once we had transfected them, and we found something a little bit different, which is if you look at the red triangles here, that's the values we found with interferon alpha, and the green is with add IL-12. And you can see there's a bunch of red triangles up here where various things are elevated, including FGF, GCSF, GM-CSF, IL-1 receptor alpha, and IP-10, a few other things. So the interferon transfection increased a lot of different things, and we're not sure. We are trying to figure this out, what's going on, but these cells also have interferon receptors, so it may be self-stimulating for a number of different pathways. But and everything else was negative. And if you look at the IL-12, there's only one thing that's elevated in IL-12, and that's IL-12. So the IL-12 transfected cells are kind of an attractive thing, because there's only one thing that it's doing, and it's producing IL-12. So then we want to look and see the effect of these cells, both interferon and IL-12, on T cells, CD4 and CD8 positive T cells. And so we got peripheral blood lymphocytes from our patients, and we looked at the effect of adding these cells adding the mesenchymal stem cells to the peripheral blood lymphocytes. And there was some baseline appearance of 12% CD4 cells, 39% CD8 cells, and then we mock transfected it, which really didn't change anything. Interestingly, the interferon alpha decreased both the CD4 and CD8 cells for some reason. So it looked like it was really immunosuppressive almost, and we're still trying to explain that. But the IL-12 transfected cells increased both the CD4 and CD8 cells substantially. So we want to see how stimulatory the secretions and everything from the cells would be for actual stimulation of CD4 and CD8 lymphocytes. So we use a system where there's a little bit of baseline stimulation with PHA to get the cells started, and then we looked at adding the mesenchymal stem cells. And basically, these are all the controls, which are relatively low and constant, but the IL-12 cells, and there's two lines here. This is the cells, and this is supernatants that we took off. Basically, have the same effect and increase the CD4 and CD8 cells substantially to a very high percentage. This is just CD8. I looked that wrong. And this is CD4. So CD4 was increased, but to a much lesser degree. This is just looking at a maximal stimulation that we did with CD3 and CD28 co-stimulation, and our cells got pretty close to them, but not quite close to maximal stimulation. And this was just some information looking at IL-12 combined with IL-2. So the bottom panel here is just control cells, and then the next one up is IL-2, which shows some increase in the CD8 cells here, and then you look at IL-12 and IL-2 together, there's actually a much bigger increase at the top. So there may be some rationale for using IL-2 and IL-12 together. So the question is, how do we deliver these cells? We can do them intraoperatively potentially. That was one of the things I was originally interested in, but we could also do it intravenously. If you do it intraoperatively, obviously you have to do an operation, so that, if you do it, it's a one-time thing generally. And so if you have to redose or you want to treat patients without surgery, you're kind of stuck. So this is some interesting information that was published in 2014 in Thorax, where this is a mesenchymal stem cell model where a trail was used to transfect with mesenchymal stem cells. And I know it's hard to see this, so I apologize, but But this is the animals that are controlled, and what they did is they looked at injecting IV mesenchymal stem cells versus intrapleural, or intraperitoneal, I think it was, stem cells, so, or intrapleural, yeah. So what they did at the top, this is a control, so this is what the animals look like if they just have no cells at all. And the mesenchymal stem cells only, you don't really get much of a change. If you do the trail, this is a trail intrapleurally, which basically may be better than this, but not substantially in terms of tumor control, but then the IV ones actually did better. So the question is, you know, that's an interesting observation, because the question is, should we not actually be injecting them during surgery, but just wait until afterwards and then inject the cells intravenously afterwards and have a better effect? So that's something that we're going to look into. And this just showed that if you do IV injections, the necrosis that you see in the tumors is just much greater. So somehow the intravenous injection allows these cells to traffic to the areas of actual tumor and may not get lost within the pleural space and not actually get into the tumor. So one of the conclusions is that I think mesenchymal stem cells could be potentially a good delivery vehicle for delivering immunologic molecules. Potentially, you can even imagine having different cells, the IL-12 cell, IL-2 cell. You can mix them, match them kind of thing, and then give them intravenously. If that's really the way you can give them, then that would be kind of convenient. And they do tend to have a low amount of side effects just by themselves, and so you could produce a significant amount of cytokines locally in the tumor and potentially get a pretty good response. So we're interested in pursuing those more. And again, never give up.